The American Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, is due to attend her first meeting of NATO foreign ministers in Brussels later today. Correspondents say the talks, which come ahead of Mrs. Albright's visit to Moscow later this week, will focus on the expansion of the alliance into Central and Eastern Europe. Talks have been continuing in Madrid between representatives of the Spanish government and striking truck drivers to try to end the drivers' dispute over fuel prices and working conditions. And that's the summary.
The Japanese Red Army. You could be forgiven for thinking the violent urban guerrilla organization was dead and buried. Apparently not. But it has suffered something of a setback. Five of its members have just been arrested in Lebanon and may face extradition back to Japan. I spoke to Bill Farrell, author of Blood and Rage, a study of the group, and asked him what he knew about the arrested men.
Well, of the five people that were arrested, Mr. Okamoto is the one that is most known, and he was one of the three attackers back in 1972 at Lod Airport in Israel, and he was the only survivor of the three Japanese who attacked. I mean, it was a massacre. The target was to be as many Israelis as they could kill. As fate would have it, they actually killed more people from Puerto Rico than they did from Israel.
Now, Mr. Okamoto was released in a prisoner exchange between Israel and the Palestinians in May 1985.
That's correct.
The Japanese government then has been anxious to get its hands on him since then?
Well, they've been anxious to get their hands on all the members of the Japanese Red Army, so they've never quite let up their vigilance.
Now, it's a very long time since we heard the name. We associate it very much with the 1970s. They're not still a threat, are they?
Not as they once were, of course, but quite frankly, over the years, when they first started out in the early 70s, you had people in their 20s, early 30s, and now in their mid to upper 50s, it's just been a little more difficult for them to get a following, and they never really had a large ideological following in Japan. They teamed up with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, but they were more activists as opposed to ideologues, so it was difficult to build up a following based on any form of ideology. In fact, even though they were based in the Middle East, most of their activity was outside the Middle East against quote-unquote imperialism, whether it was Japan Airlines and the symbol of Japanese imperialism or U.S. military facilities or embassies or at The Hague when they participated. They've done work with Carlos. They've done work with the Germans. They've done work with other groups. They have freelanced quite a bit.
And what keeps them at it all these years on? Are they in it for the money, or are they just ideologues who won't lie down?
Their lifestyle over the past several years has not been all that good. They have no homeland to come back to in many respects. And none of these folks who were in the Japanese Red Army were ever part of the mainstream. A lot of them were having difficulties at school. They didn't get into the best universities. There were all kinds of reasons for them to be socially on the outside. And they found some form of identity within this particular group or within the activity of leftist and terrorist organizations. There were some major arrests in the late 1980s, which took them down a peg, and I'm sure these arrests will also hurt them a little more.
The author, Bill Farrell. Yesterday's attack by Zairean government planes on rebel-held areas in the east of the country suggests that its counteroffensive, which has had little effect so far, may be entering a new phase. Among the targets was the border town of Bukavu. One of the international agencies operating there is the UN's World Food Programme. I spoke to Stefano Poretti at WFP's headquarters in Rome. What information had he received about the raid?
It seems that were two aircraft and there were four bombs that fell in the town of Bukavu. Two more or less located in the market called Katudu, one very close to our office, some 50 meters from our office. And another one in another point.
What did your colleagues in Bukavu say about the reaction of the people to this raid?
According to them, the local population, of course, had a moment of fear, and people seemed that they were preparing themselves to leave the town for going to the hills.
What's the situation in Bukavu at the moment in general? Very full of refugees?
There is still a steady flow of refugees coming from west and crossing through Bukavu, going to Rwanda, through the Changugu-Bukavu border point.
Have you been able to get any information from the Zairean government about what they're up to?
Not negative, not for the time being.
Stefano Poretti of the World Food Programme. Well, what is the government saying? News of the air raids has been welcomed in the capital, Kinshasa. Joseph Lunda Mwewa is a member of parliament for President Mobutu's ruling party and deputy governor of Shaba province, scene of some of the recent fighting. I asked him what he made of yesterday's action.
The operation is very successful, yes. You know that we want to pull out rebels to persuade the enemy that we are a big country and we have all power to pull them out.
Why has it taken the government so long to take action like this?
This is a big question. You know that in the first time, we are a Pacific nation. But now you know that humiliation is very, very, very big. And the international community did nothing to stop the action of rebels. So that now we decide ourselves to stop this action.
What was the nationality of the pilots in the planes, do you think?
The nationality of flying. This is the Zairean national flying.
You don't think the pilots were from Ukraine?
No. You know that Evne is from Ukraine. We have some planes, Mirage, from France. You know that the action is very, very big. But what I can say that all of that planes is from our Zairean forces.
But how important is the help of foreign soldiers, foreign personnel in your war effort?
The question is very good. But the question you can also ask to the nation who are trying to help the rebels to attack our national territory. For us, even if someone, I can say that a mercenary, to defend our national territory, we will try to do all. What we want is to defend our national territory. Now, you know that we can't accept the humiliation, and we try to do all to save our national territory and the integrity of territory.
Joseph Lunda Mwewa on the line from Kinshasa. 1,500 members of Brazil's largest grassroots popular organization, the Landless Peasants Movement, MST, have completed the first day of a protest march to the Brazilian capital, Brasilia. The march, which is expected to last 2 months, is in support of demands for faster land reform. From Sao Paulo, Jan Rocha reports.
Carrying the red flags of the MST and banners demanding land reform, the march has set out from cities in three different states to converge on the capital. They spent the first night sleeping in churches and sports halls. The MST, who have organized scores of invasions of large cattle ranches all over Brazil, accused the government of dragging its feet over land reform. The government denies this, saying it has done more than any previous government to expropriate ranches and large estates and distribute land. The marchers plan to reach Brasilia on the 17th of April. On this day, a year ago, police in the Amazon state of Pará shot at another group of marchers who'd blockaded a road to demand land reform and killed 19 of them near a small town called El Dourado de Carajás. The purpose of the march is to remind Brazilians that nobody has yet been brought to trial for the murders. It's certainly no coincidence that the Minister of Justice chose the same day the march began to start a week-long trip to the region and announce the appointment of a special prosecutor in an effort to speed up the trial of the 155 policemen charged with the killings, who all remain on active service.
Jan Rocha reporting from Sao Paulo. You're listening to Newsday in the World Service of the BBC. Villagers in southwestern Angola have been fleeing in their hundreds in recent days during a spate of attacks by soldiers from the former rebel movement UNITA. The villagers arriving in the city of Kubal speak of shooting and burning by uniformed men. Barnaby Phillips is our correspondent in the capital, Luanda.
I understand that about 200 people arrived in Kubal on Monday. They said they'd left in an awful hurry. They'd left dead and wounded people behind, and they said that villages were still being burnt to the south of Kubal.
It's more than 2 years after the peace agreement. How is it possible that UNITA soldiers are roaming the countryside wreaking this sort of havoc?
Well, first of all, it should be said that this particular area around Benguela Huambo and Huila province is notorious. It's known as a sort of Bermuda Triangle of banditry. It's known to be, at the moment, the most dangerous place in the country. This particular wave of violence has been going on for 6 months. What seems to be the problem is that there are badly disciplined government soldiers, civil militia groups who are armed by the government, so there's no shortage of weapons in the area, and then UNITA soldiers. Now, because the peace process has been going so slowly, many UNITA soldiers have drifted out of the United Nations quartering camps that they ought to be in, and are resorting to all sorts of other ways of making a living. This was always a contested area. It's agriculturally rich. There's a lot of cattle rustling that's always gone on. And the violence there seems to have taken on an endemic and tit-for-tat quality that is now beginning to spiral.
What does this latest unrest tell us about the kind of obstacles which the government in Luanda faces in getting the peace process really to work?
Well, I think on the positive side, what we should emphasise is that there's no evidence that the UNITA leadership or the government leadership sitting in Luanda are in any ways behind this. This seems to be people on the ground who are out of control. Having said that, it is indicative of all sorts of problems that the government has got as it tries to extend its control over UNITA-held areas. I understand that in this particular part of Benguela province, civil militia groups moved in as the UNITA troops went into the United Nations quartering camps. Now, if that's happening in Benguela province, it's likely to happen in an awful lot of other areas because the government still only controls something like 30 to 40% of Angolan territory. If the government, for example, were to try and extend its control into diamond mining areas, the Lunda Nort province in the north, you'd see violence on a much bigger scale. So that shows how there are still real fundamental problems. The country is not united, it's divided.
Barnaby Phillips in Luanda. Here in Britain, the government has survived a crucial vote on a censure motion tabled by the opposition Labour Party. Had the government been defeated, there could have been a no-confidence vote and a possible early general election. The vote was 320 to 307, a comfortable majority in the end for the government. But both sides are claiming to have come out on top, as our British Affairs analyst Nick Childs reports.
The ayes to the right were 307. The noes to the left were 320.
Yeah! The voting arithmetic was against Labour once the Ulster Unionist MPs from Northern Ireland had decided to abstain. But the Labour Party was in a difficult position. The government has no overall majority, Labour leader Tony Blair has been calling for an early general election, and there'd been increasing pressure from Labour supporters for the opposition to try to force the government out. Had Labour done nothing, it would have been accused of weakness. The crisis over BSE or mad cow disease, the actual subject of the Labour censure motion, looked like an attractive issue for Labour. But the party's leaders angered the other opposition parties by failing to consult them beforehand. After the vote, ministers said Labour had bungled its efforts and harmed Britain's interests on the BSE issue. The government hopes its survival will boost its supporters' morale and defuse speculation about a possible early election. For Labour, the vote will be a disappointment, as this was probably its best chance of inflicting a significant parliamentary defeat on the government. But it believes that it's been able to highlight an issue on which the government is particularly unpopular, and that it's shown that this is a lame duck government, desperate to delay an election as long as possible. An election that must be held in 3 months anyway.
Nick Charles reporting. Still to come on Newsday, Madeleine Albright's tour of Europe continues, with NATO and trade relations on today's agenda. And the Spanish truck driver's strike. What are the long-term economic consequences? A reminder of our top story. Japan has sent officials to Lebanon to seek the extradition of members of the Japanese Red Army extremist group who've been detained by the Lebanese authorities. It's Tuesday, and for Madeleine Albright, that means it's Brussels. The new American Secretary of State is in the thick of a European tour, which today takes her first to NATO headquarters in the Belgian capital. The tour seems to be going well. The French Foreign Minister, Hervé de Charette, said his talks with the Secretary of State had been very warm. Our State Department correspondent, Chris Morris, is travelling with Madeleine Albright.
Well, what she's been doing since she arrived in Europe is really canvassing opinion and discussing the American position, both on the expansion of NATO and the equally important decision, how does NATO persuade Russia that NATO expansion isn't a threat to Moscow's security? She's held talks already in Rome, in Bonn and in Paris. She'll now be going to NATO to try and crystallise some sort of common position. It's not going to be a final position, and that's the sort of thing she'll be taking to Moscow when she visits there later in the week.
Now, of course, the French are very keen that NATO's Southern Command should be headed by a European officer. Was there any sign of progress on that issue?
No, there wasn't really any progress at all. The French reiterated their position. The Americans, I think, probably said it rather politely, but their position is that that command will stay an American command. That's what it's always been historically. And that is an irritant in relation between US and France, which I think will continue. I don't think it's necessarily going to affect the issue of expansion to the east, though, and that's really the biggest issue facing NATO as a whole. There have always been a few difficulties in relations between the US and France, but the focus at the moment is on broader European security, specifically the issue of Russia.
Our correspondent Chris Morris. During her Brussels visit, the Secretary of State is also due to meet the President of the European Commission, Jacques Santer, and the EU's Commissioner for External Trade, Sir Leon Britton. Top of the agenda, the so-called Helms-Burton Law. Our Brussels correspondent David Eads explains.
The Helms-Burton Law is an American attempt to prohibit foreign companies from trading through Cuban firms which once belonged to the Americans. In US eyes, it's a step in the pursuit of democracy for Cuba. The EU shares the American democratic ideal, but fiercely resents the tactics. Sir Leon Britton is the European Commissioner for EU-US trade relations.
Well, for the United States to attack European companies is just making Castro laugh all the way to the bank. It's absolutely ridiculous. But the fact is that the United States has passed legislation and is applying legislation which is doing economic, substantial economic damage to the European Union and its companies. And we think that that is unlawful and it is unjustified, it is unfriendly, it is unnecessary and it is unproductive.
Which is why the EU has appealed to the World Trade Organization to rule on whether or not the US can impose unilateral laws regarding trade on another country. The WTO will have to decide whether this is a simple trade issue or if, as the US argues, national security is at stake. After 3 months of haggling over who should sit on the panel to take such a decision, the WTO's Secretary General, Renato Ruggiero, has until Thursday to make his own choice, which is binding on both sides. It's turning into a testing case for the WTO, as Keith Rockwell, Mr. Ruggiero's spokesman, acknowledges.
Well, there's no question it's a sensitive issue, but the way the system is set up, we encourage the parties to reach disputes, to reach a settlement of their dispute. It's not a legal court, it's a dispute settlement system. And if the parties can resolve this at some point before the issue plays itself through, well, we'd be quite happy with that.
Leon Britton sees little sign of an approaching settlement, yet nor does he believe the United States wants the WTO's panel to decide the case for them.
You never want a panel if you think you're going to lose. But the arguments that they put forward are unacceptable and unsustainable. You can't simply say this is a foreign policy question and we decide it's a foreign policy question. You can't be judge and jury in your own cause. Security. I can understand if we were exporting nuclear missiles to Cuba, but to carry on an ordinary business with hotels and things like that, somebody other than the United States has got to decide whether that is damaging to their security.
The EU's Commissioner for External Trade, Sir Leon Britton. So, does Madeleine Albright have anything encouraging to say to her European hosts? Back to our State Department correspondent, Chris Morris.
The Americans are still very firm that their policy is the correct one, that countries such as Cuba, which is affected by Helms-Burton, and also Iran and Libya, which are affected by another law, should not be rewarded with trade from European countries. It's an issue which has really bedeviled relations across the Atlantic for a year, and it's very difficult to see an obvious compromise.
In the run-up to the American elections, there was speculation that once re-elected, Bill Clinton would quietly drop those clauses in Helms-Burton that did penalise European companies trading with Cuba. Is that a less likely prospect now?
Well, what he's done is agree to postpone again one particular clause which would penalise specific companies for specific reasons, one very particular clause. He's probably going to postpone that clause indefinitely, as he has the right to do under the law. But there are plenty of other parts of the law which are still there, which it's much more difficult for him to affect because Congress has written the law in that way. For example, there are executives of European countries and Canadian and other countries, from Mexico, for example, who are no longer allowed to have visas to enter the United States because of their business with Cuba. So even though President Clinton has already watered down some of the worst aspects of Helms-Burton from the European perspective, there are others which are still there, and the principle is one which the Europeans find very distasteful.
Our State Department correspondent Chris Morris. In Spain, the truck drivers' strike may finally be running out of steam. Traffic is flowing freely in much of the country, and talks are still going on between the government and the unions. But fears have already been voiced about the strike's long-term economic consequences. I spoke to Adela Gooch, Madrid correspondent for The Guardian newspaper, and began by asking her whether the two sides were any closer to an agreement.
I think the will to bring this dispute to an end is certainly there, but people are getting bogged down with the actual details of the settlement. One of the first concessions that was made last week was on a demand that the truckers had to be allowed to negotiate their own discounts on diesel. Now, the government said that was fine, that they would be allowed discounts up to 10% per litre, but now the petrol companies are saying that that's untenable and shouldn't be allowed to go through. The other major demand that the truckers are making is to be allowed to have an optional lower retirement age, i.e. to be allowed to retire at 55. Again, the government in principle thinks this is a good idea, but the accounts people are now saying that that could knock the pension system out of line and have implications for Spain's very strong desire to form part of the first phase of monetary union, knock its deficit down, keep its inflation rate down.
Well, we'll come back to that in a moment. Tell us a little bit about Fedatrans, the union at the heart of this strike, small but radical.
Exactly. Fedatrans is based in the Basque country, so a radical area anyway. And it was really when their people decided to go out on strikes, the rest of the country followed, I think because it simply tapped a nerve. The truckers have had long-standing demands for their sector to be renegotiated. These have been on the table since the socialists were in power. There have been strikes in the past, and suddenly the Fedatrans action was the spark that lit the whole tinkerbox.
Now, we've been hearing in recent days about some of the wider economic implications of this strike, and particularly on the car industry. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about that.
Yes, Spain has a fair number of car plants, all sorts of companies, Nissan, Citroën, Mercedes-Benz. Now, they depend on very regular distribution of component parts. As soon as that system breaks down, then they grind to a halt. And from the middle of last week, they've been shutting down, they've been laying workers off. That has also had a knock-on effect in other countries that rely on what happens here, Germany in particular. So we've been hearing real squeals of anguish from the car industry and from industrialists generally, who say a strike of this type is something that Spain simply can't afford in its race to meet the Maastricht criteria.
Well, now, you mentioned the Maastricht criteria, obviously uppermost in the minds of many European governments. What fears are there at the moment that this strike and that any concessions to these strikers could impact seriously on Spain's economy in the run-up to that all-important decision?
It's hard to say at this stage the degree of losses involved. I think the strike is coming to an end. But I think one of the reasons behind the very strong pressure and the speed with which the government's been trying to settle it, and indeed their willingness to grant concessions to the truckers, has been the sense that Spain's books are very, very finely tuned to get to Maastricht, and that the slightest adverse factor like this one really could knock it all for six.
Adela Gooch in Madrid. It takes more than 10 hours to fly from Tokyo to Los Angeles. The giant American corporation Boeing now promises to cut that down to a little over 4 hours. Boeing's new generation of supersonic aircraft is still under development, but details of the project have just been unveiled at a meeting in Seattle of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And as Tracy Logan reports, flying faster than the speed of sound may soon be something more of us can experience.
This is a final call for the last two remaining passengers traveling on British Airways Concorde Supersonic, flight BA001 to New York. Your flight is now waiting to depart.
For now, supersonic travel is a luxury few can afford. But if all goes to plan, Boeing hope their new high-speed civil transport, or HSCT, will hit the skies in the year 2010 at a ticket price ordinary air travellers can afford.
What we're looking at is a fare structure for all three classes of service that's maybe only 20% higher than today. So not only the businessmen who want to get to Tokyo early and refreshed for a meeting will attract a lot of tourist passengers as well.
Malcolm McKinnon is the programme manager at Boeing who will oversee the development of this new aircraft.
They would look reasonably similar to Concorde. They'd be very much bigger, three times the passenger payload, twice the range. Second generation airplane would probably be 100 metres long and about 50 metres in wingspan. It would weigh a little less than a 747. And the other important element for the next generation of airplanes is its range capability. The Concorde can just barely fly across the Atlantic, 3,500 miles. That's what it was designed for. This one has to be a worldwide airplane, so it has to have trans-Pacific range. And it will have a range of at least 5,000 miles and probably more.
Estimating the potential market for these aircraft, Boeing reckons that 10% of the world's air fleet will be supersonic by the year 2025, 50 years after Concorde first took to the skies. But right now, engineers have a job on their hands to find new materials to cope with the excessive stresses and strains of the HSCT during flight. Bill Quist is the principal materials engineer on the project.
Well, an airplane is an airplane, so the basic stresses and strains are taken care of by the design of the airplane and what it needs. We have added requirements here because the airplane is going to be pretty hot. At the Mach number that we intend to try and fly at, which is 2.4 at the present time, a little over twice the speed of sound, the temperatures range up to about 175 degrees Celsius. For example, that's quite a little bit hotter than the Concorde, which is flying at around 100 degrees Celsius. The aerodynamic heating takes it up there. We have to choose the materials very carefully that have that capability. And, for example, Concorde is made out of aluminum alloy. For this aircraft, which flies somewhat hotter, aluminum really doesn't hang in there very well. And so we're looking at titanium alloys, and we're looking at certain types of composite materials that have a temperature capability in this temperature range.
Apart from its size and speed, the HSCT looked remarkably similar to Concorde in an artist's impression. Sadly, there's no sign of the quirky nose, but the sonic boom will remain, and the HSCT will have to slow down over land to minimise the nuisance. Malcolm McKinnon again.
The strength of the sonic boom is due to the speed of the airplane, the weight of the airplane, and the altitude of the airplane. And being a bigger airplane than Concorde and a faster airplane than Concorde, the sonic boom is going to be a little higher than what it is with Concorde. So we just have to make sure that we only boom wide expanses of empty ocean.
Boeing's Malcolm McKinnon, ending that report by Tracy Logan. And a look at the closing headline. Japan has sent officials to Lebanon to seek the extradition of members of the Japanese Red Army extremist group who've been detained by the Lebanese authorities. A look at the markets. The Dow Jones was closed on Monday for a public holiday. In Tokyo, the Nikkei has closed down 279 at 18,470. And the dollar is currently trading at 124.6 Japanese yen and at one German mark, 70.3. That's it for now. From me, Paul Adams, and the Newsday team here in London, goodbye.
Our next news is in half an hour from now at 7 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time. That's followed by What's News, our programme for young people, which looks behind the major stories and includes a reporter's competition. And then at 7.30, Tim Smith counts down the multi-track hit list. That's in an hour from now. You're listening to programmes from the BBC World Service, and we're broadcasting from our studios here at Bush House in the centre of London.